I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, the Republican Colin Powell endorses the Democrat presidential nominee Barack Obama.
Because of his ability to inspire, because of the inclusive nature of his campaign, because he is reaching out all across America, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
In the historically Republican state of Virginia, the Powell view isn't necessarily the everyman view.
I was talking to one gentleman about that. He says, I was wearing my Obama shirt, and my next door neighbor says, if I see you wear that again, I'll burn your house down. And I was like, whoa.
The government sets out its economic recovery program, the extinction threat to India's tigers.
We may have in the last 5 years lost 2,500 tigers to poachers.
And the MOD opens its UFO files.
Among them was a letter from a woman writing to the MOD who claims that sadly she crash-landed in World War II in her spacecraft with two fellas she had with her, and who were actually from a different planet.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
First, a roundup of the day's news plus the day's papers with Sandy Waugh.
Business confidence in Britain is at a record low and the economy is tipping into recession, new figures are showing. A survey for Lloyds TSB showed two-thirds of firms are more pessimistic about the outlook for the economy than they were last month. Data published later today will also show a widening budget deficit. And experts warn the government's plans to boost spending in the face of the recession will cause national debt to grow significantly. Barack Obama's campaign to become President of the United States has been lifted by the support of Colin Powell, George Bush's former Secretary of State. With 15 days to go until the election, Obama also revealed that his campaign had raised record funds in September. National polls continue to show that the Republican candidate John McCain is failing to close the gap of 4 to 7 points on his Democratic rival. A pilot has been arrested on a passenger jet at Heathrow on suspicion of being drunk, a spokeswoman for the Metropolitan Police has confirmed. The 44-year-old man was arrested following a breath test as the plane waited at Heathrow's Terminal 1 yesterday morning. The man was a first officer for United Airlines and was due to embark on a flight to San Francisco prior to his arrest. The number of extradition cases being dealt with in UK courts has reached record levels, fuelled by a number of trivial requests from Europe, The Guardian has learned. The increase is largely down to the volume of European arrest warrants, many of them issued by Poland. Among the cases were a man wanted for theft of some cupboard doors, a Lithuanian piglet rustler, and a man wanted for the theft of a pudding. It's been a successful weekend in British sport. Lewis Hamilton won the Chinese Grand Prix in Shanghai yesterday, leaving him needing only a fifth-place finish in Brazil next week to win the Drivers' Championship. And in tennis, another victory for Andy Murray. He won the Madrid Masters to secure back-to-back series wins. Now for a look at today's papers, and the FT leads with news that the banking and insurance group ING has received a €10 billion cash injection from the Dutch state. The bank recently took over responsibility for deposits of 160,000 UK customers with the Icelandic bank Kaupthing Edge. A YouGov poll in the Mirror shows the Conservatives now have an 8-point lead over Labour. This has been cut from the 22-point lead they held 3 months ago and is a further sign, according to the Mirror, of a brown bounce. The Telegraph quotes a study that claims the UK economy won't recover until 2011, while the Mail launches a campaign to see a fair deal for small businesses. The Independent reports the government could delay plans to allow flexible working for 4.5 million parents to help take some of the strain off businesses. The Times claims family courts are to be opened up to the media in response to criticism from some families. The children taken into care are victims of secret justice. The Sun continues its in-depth coverage of the breakup of Madonna's marriage. Today, the paper claims she's called her husband Guy Ritchie a gold digger. On the back pages, it's more misery for supporters of Tottenham Hotspur, with the club officially having their worst ever start to a season. Yesterday's 2-1 defeat at Stoke leaves them with no wins in 8 games and adrift at the bottom of the Premier League. Their manager Juan de Ramos has said he's worried and is clinging to his job, according to the Mail. More on the day's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
First, it seems friendship means nothing in politics. The former American Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has snubbed his friend John McCain to endorse Barack Obama. Powell, who has served 3 Republican presidents, prefers the Democrat, who he believes all Americans, not just African Americans, will be proud of as president.
But which is the president that we need now? Which is the individual that serves the needs of the nation for the next period of time. And I come to the conclusion that because of his ability to inspire, because of the inclusive nature of his campaign, because he is reaching out all across America, because of who he is and his rhetorical abilities, and we have to take that into account, as well as his substance. He has both style and substance. He has met the standard of being a successful president, being an exceptional president. I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
Speaking to U.S. TV show Meet the Press, he has criticized John McCain's negative campaigning and his choice of running mate, Sarah Palin. Guardian correspondent Dan Glaister has been telling us whether this endorsement carries any weight.
The short answer is yes, it carries an enormous amount of weight. He's a senior, respected figure across the political spectrum, with some caveats, which I'll come to. He's, until recently, probably the best-known African-American politician in this country. And he has enormous clout in that has been perceived as being possibly Barack Obama's weak spot compared to John McCain, which is national security or foreign policy, however you want to term it. So it's a sort of reassuring thing, I think, possibly for the wavering voters, people who might have been leaning towards the Democrats and towards Obama on economic grounds, but might have harbored some sort of uncertainties on national security grounds. So I think it sort of will soothe those people and will help the Democrats usher them into the Obama camp. As regards Democrats who are already voting for Obama, then it's possibly a different story, because Powell obviously has a slightly tainted record with many people. I mean, notably for his February 2003 speech to the UN, which laid out the justification for going to war with Iraq. And Powell has subsequently described that as a blot on his record. But even with that sort of mea culpa, I think his standing among many liberal Democrats was harmed.
The two men, Colin Powell and John McCain, are friends, aren't they? Have been for years. How has McCain responded?
The only way he could do, to say, I have tremendous respect for Colin Powell, and he's a friend, and I respect his decision, and I'm pleased to, note that I have the support of four other former secretaries of state. There is a personal relationship between the two, but I think they would both say, well, it's politics and it's a dirty game. But nevertheless, you do have to feel that, yes, if they have known each other and been friends and colleagues for so many years, then it is going to sting, really, that some of the criticisms that came from Powell, because he didn't only criticise the policies that have come from the McCain campaign. He criticised the style of the campaign, and that really has to come down ultimately to John McCain. For example, he criticised the sort of rightward drift of the party over the last few months as the campaign has intensified, and he criticised the selection of Sarah Palin as McCain's running mate, and he said something along the lines of, that makes you question his judgment.
Another boost to Barack Obama is the news that his campaign has raised a record-breaking $150 million in just the month of September. And with just 15 days left to go before the US elections, he's been clocking up the air miles as well, flying in and out of the swing states with the concomitant presidential hullabaloo. And where candidates go, so follows the media. But not The Guardian's Gary Young. He's strayed from the pack to spend the run-up to the election in Roanoke in Virginia. He's been there 3 weeks now and has noticed a real turnaround in the fortunes of the presidential nominees.
It's really like a small Democratic island in a sea of Republicanism. You have to drive 4 miles to the west and 2 hours to the south to get to the next Democratic county. So the question is, why Roanoke? Well, there are a few options. I could have gone to Ohio, I could have gone to Florida, but it really felt to me like Virginia, which has been a Republican state for more than 40 years, but now there's a possibility that it might go Democratic, was really emblematic of this 2008 presidential election. I'm really glad I did stay here, because I've met the most tremendous motley group of people. And a couple of the people that I've met here that I really liked are Anna and Brandon, who run Pops Ice Cream and Soda. Hey, Brandon. How you doing? So, Brandon, for someone who's not been to Roanoke, how would you kind of describe the city?
So it's a surprising city because for the size of it, you would think there's nothing to do here, but there's really a lot of entertainment, a lot of arts, a lot of grassroots people. And this neighborhood in particular where we're at, everyone knows everyone's family, everyone walks.
Do you hear much politics being talked about in the bar?
In this neighborhood, we do especially. I mean, we're an ice cream shop, so people come here and talk, have their ice cream sodas, and we talk to a lot of people, both Republican and Democrat.
You told me a story a while back about some people sitting at the counter. Could you just tell us that story again?
Yeah, we were talking about how people that are for Obama sometimes aren't really too vocal about it because I think there's some kind of fear. I found that a lot here, especially being a business owner, we can't talk politics too much to our customers. We don't want to lose the business. But I was talking to one gentleman about that, and he says, I was wearing my Obama shirt, and my next-door neighbor says, if I see you wearing that again, I'll burn your house down. And I was like, whoa.
All cell phones and cameras must be turned on for inspection. Make sure you get all the metal out of your pockets when you go through the detector.
So we're standing outside the Roanoke Civic Center, which is a concrete monstrosity. And there are thousands of people here who have come to see Barack Obama, who's arrived in town for the first time. What's interesting about the fact that he's in Roanoke is that Roanoke is in the most hostile region of Virginia. Southwest Virginia is the most pro-Republican area in the whole state. And so Obama is really here behind enemy lines.
Start the drama and rock Obama t-shirt.
What brought you out today?
Barack Obama.
Okay, but why do you like him?
I like his issues, especially Social Security, education, all of that.
Hard time, nothing to eat, we'll do it. No jobs, you name it. Everything starts with a no.
Do the people you know, like your families, are they supporting Obama?
Actually, no. My family's really staunch Republicans. I try to convince them as hard as I can.
Why are they supporting McCain?
They don't like the taxes on small businesses. They're small business owners.
I see you've got a Conservatives for Obama poster. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, many conservatives in this country are starting to speak out against the McCain-Palin ticket. I originally was a supporter of Ron Paul. I just feel that fiscally, as well as in terms of foreign policy and in terms of civil rights, Obama is much more in line with my beliefs and where I think the country needs to go than the McCain-Palin ticket.
Do you think his race is going to be a factor?
I hope not. But we still have people that live, you know, in the past.
I think it's going to cancel out. Blacks will vote for him because he's black. There's some that will, and there's whites that won't because he's black. And I think it's a wash.
Does it surprise you that Virginia might be going Democrat?
No, it does not. It's about time.
I see a lot of Obama signs, a lot more than I see of McCain signs. And for an area that is usually Republican, I think that says a lot.
Thank you, everybody. What a great crowd here in Roanoke. For those of you who are getting a little cocky, who support me and start reading the polls, I just got two words for you. New Hampshire, we've got to keep fighting for every vote. We can do this. Americans have done it before, but I need you to stand up.
So the rally's just finished there, and it's one of the best speeches I've seen Obama give. But he's really playing to the faithful, and he's really preaching to the choir. And that's fine, because the choir needs to have a song to sing. So now we're going to go across town where there's a Republican event going on, the first in the 3 weeks since I've been here, and see what they've got to say. We're in an empty garage just over the road with kind of half-fixed cars on hoists and bits of machinery. And there are about seven Republicans and nine members of the press. It's a really surreal scene. There are some kind of sad-looking old men and one teenager holding McCain and Palin signs. This is the Republican response to the first visit from a presidential candidate in Roanoke since 1960 and one of the biggest political events that this city's ever seen. And quite frankly, it's pathetic. I'm here with William Fralin, who's in the state legislature, in the House of Delegates, representing parts of Roanoke City, Roanoke County, and Bottonton. I think the last six polls in Virginia have had John McCain behind. Do you think the Republicans can still win Virginia?
You know, I certainly think John McCain still has a chance to win Virginia. And I wouldn't be shocked if he did. and I wouldn't be shocked if he didn't at this point. You know, I think it's going to be close.
I've been here for 3 weeks now, and I fully expected, honestly, that either John McCain or Sarah Palin would have come down this way. It's just their strongest bit of Virginia, whereas we've had Obama, Bill Clinton, Evan Bayh, and Terry McAuliffe.
He needs to get down here. You know, I really think that. Now, he's running a national campaign. He's, you know, they are much more in tune with the polls and where all they need to be and make those decisions. That's not up to me to make those decisions. But I agree with you. It would be helpful to have him here, and I would not be surprised if we did not see either he or Governor Palin in this area between now and the election. I think either one would be fine.
Just so long as somebody comes.
Somebody.
So in the 3 weeks that I've been in Roanoke, the political culture and nature of the town has been completely transformed. When I arrived, Democrats were in the closet. But in the 3 weeks that I've been here, they've really been fired up. They've basically outmaneuvered and outspent the Republicans. When I arrived, it was a swing state. Now it's leaning Obama and keeps leaning more and more towards Obama with every passing day. I've heard a number of Republicans here say that if John McCain can't take Virginia, he can't win the presidency.
The Guardian's Gary Young in Roanoke, Virginia.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, a plan to curb the rising unemployment numbers by retraining the jobless as nuclear reactor inspectors. Details at guardian.co.uk/UK. Celebrity photographer Rankin swaps the catwalk for the war zone. Pictures at guardian.co.uk/culture. How the digital switchover will affect rural areas. That story sent digitally to our reliable website at guardian.co.uk/media. And scouts are being given be prepared sex advice. guardian.co.uk/society.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Next. Whether we like it or not, we have to face up to our financial future. And the question today is, what has the government got in store for us? To answer this and more, we're joined by The Guardian's economics correspondent, Ashley Seeger, who's been reviewing the cabinet plans to kickstart the economy.
Well, we've learned what I think we probably already knew deep down is that borrowing is going to rise as we go into recession because spending increases on unemployment and other benefits while tax revenues get very badly hit in an economic slowdown because unemployment rises, income tax receipts fall, corporation tax receipts fall, capital gains tax receipts, lots of receipts fall basically, so the deficit is going to blow out. What I think the government has indicated this weekend more strenuously than before is that they're going to allow that to happen. Because prudence would dictate that you should cut spending and raise taxes in response to that. But they're saying, no, we'll let borrowing rise because to do otherwise would be to clobber the economy.
Well, can you clarify one point for me on the back of that? We've heard Alistair Darling said, as you just said, he's going to use public spending to boost the economy. But we've also heard Lord Mandelson saying it's not a spend, spend, spend approach. So,
well, what the Treasury is saying to us is that this isn't new money. This is about bringing forward construction projects such as Crossrail or schools and hospitals that were going to be built in 2010, 2011, 2012. They might start those earlier, and that's because they're worried that the construction industry has collapsed because there's no house building going on, there's no commercial building going on. So they're thinking a lot of unemployed builders, let's bring forward those projects, give them something to do, give them wages, they're spending it in the economy, they're affording their mortgages so they're not getting repossessed and so on.
And people in work is obviously going to help with the numbers of repossessions, because this is something the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Yvette Cooper, has been on about over the weekend, isn't it? That home repossession should be the last resort.
Yes, absolutely. She's saying to these banks, essentially, you know, we're giving you a lot of capital to keep you afloat. The last thing we want you doing is being too aggressive with people who've fallen behind on their mortgages and throwing them out of their homes, which is just a miserable thing to do to people. It should be said that at the moment, repossession statistics are still very, very low, and certainly much lower than levels they reached in the last recession. But of course, we're at the early stages of the recession, so the point is about stopping them rising.
And there's a survey out today, isn't there? Lloyd's TSB survey on business confidence. Is there any good news there?
Not really, no. That's fallen to a record low. Admittedly, the survey has been running since 2002, so is it a record low since the last recession? Well, we don't know. Probably it is, yeah. And you would expect a survey after the few weeks we've had to be very gloomy, but it's gloomy both on the economic outlook and the sort of sales and profits outlook. You'd expect it, but it's nasty to have it confirmed just the same.
Have we had cross-party agreement over the weekend, or are the Tories going their own way?
It seems to me the Tories, I mean, they, you know, David Cameron tried to break the sort of cross-party agreement on solving the banking crisis on Friday, insisting the government had been reckless in allowing this huge build-up of personal debt and risk-taking by banks, all of which is true, but I don't particularly remember them making noises about it over the past decade. Indeed, they were the champions of deregulation of the banking system, as we well know. I think the people who come out of this looking good are the Liberal Democrats, because Vince Cable, their Treasury spokesman, has been warning 5, 6, 7 years. My email inbox has been filling up from Vince saying, we're storing up a time bomb that's going to explode, and now we know that it has exploded.
Our economics correspondent Ashley Seeger. I'm Mike Duran. Still to come on today's podcast, some of the weirder MOD files from UFO spotters. Before that, a survey by the Indian government shows there are fewer than 1,500 tigers left in the wild. The biggest threat is poaching. It's thought that hundreds are killed every year for their body parts, which are sold to buyers in China. A leading Indian conservationist, often called the David Attenborough of India, believes the only way to preserve even the last few hundred tigers is effective and stringent policing. The Guardian's Belinda Rhodes went to meet him at the Zoological Society of London.
I'm standing beside the tiger enclosure at the zoo here in the middle of London. The tiger here today is Lumpur, who's 11 years old and has lived here all his life. He's about to get a new mate called Riker, but today he's just sleeping, paying very little attention to the visitors beyond his cage. Of course, the Zoological Society of London does a great deal of work in a variety of countries to help ensure the survival of endangered species like this one. But with Indian tiger numbers dwindling rapidly, some conservationists think very serious action needs to be taken right now if the future of tigers is not to be in cages and cages alone. Valmik Thapar is one of them.
The threat is basically poaching and habitat destruction. The threat of poaching really comes from the demand on the tigers' bones and skins from China, which are across from India's borders. And there have been lots of seizures over the last 5 years in Nepal running into China, which have shown the level and scale of poaching. So the Indian poacher is being paid a fortune to go out there and kill a tiger and risk his life doing so. Our enforcement and protection mechanisms in India aren't strong enough to deal with that kind of pressure. The government now have scientifically estimated tiger populations, and they believe that it could be as low as 1,400 tigers for the whole of India. And we may have, in the last 5 years, lost 2,000, 2,500 tigers to poachers. We haven't changed the way we govern the forests of India since independence. India has changed. We are 1.2 billion people. We are a huge human landscape which is overrunning the natural landscape. And the issue really now is what we can save by making it inviolate, by protecting it, by policing it. Nobody in the world likes the thought of policing, but if we have to save even a handful of tigers, it's going to come with absolute strict policing. But policing is essential. Without policing, it's the end of the tiger.
But even the numbers that you were speaking of, that the government survey has established, are there, the 1,400, in such a vast country. And if you're losing them at that kind of rate to poaching, the situation sounds almost hopeless.
For a lot of areas, it's hopeless. The tiger was found in pockets everywhere in India. Now it's relegated to areas which are frequently visited by tourists. And we've got to think of how other areas which have been neglected, where no one goes, are saved. How do we keep the buffers intact? So many of us in India are looking at the whole business now of global warming and climate change, the importance of forests, the importance of storing carbon in forests. How do we convert farms into forests? How in the buffer can we convert agricultural fields into forests so the tiger has a buffer? And there are carbon credits that can be given to local people, which are much more than what their crop is going to give them. Some people are realizing that they don't want to lose nature's treasure house. It's the one asset which exists in every nation. And the tiger is a great symbol of it. The forests where tigers have done well are where there are no people, like Ranthambore National Park. I've just finished a book in March, April. I never expected to do this book. It's a success story. It's about hope. I never thought I'd see it. But I went there with my son, spent 10 of the best days of my life in Ranthambore National Park, where I couldn't move anywhere without bumping into tigers. So where there's good policing, where there's good protection, your tigers do really well. And it's not some magical formula that you have to evolve. It's a simple old world principle of keeping an area intact where human beings don't go in and exploit it.
Finally, today, the Ministry of Defence releases previously unseen files relating to the sighting of UFOs. Incidents are from professional pilots and those who possibly have a foot in another world themselves. The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, has read the files for us, including one alien encounter with a former US Air Force pilot.
This was a guy called Milton Torres, who at the time, he's only 25, and back in 1957, he was based at RAF Manston in Kent. And he was scrambled one evening to go and intercept a UFO that had been circling over East Anglia. So he was told to go full pelt all the way, afterburner on, pushing this thing as fast as he could go to get there. I've just been reading the documents of his account of it, and he was saying there was a blip on his radar screen that was burning a hole in it, and he was chasing this thing. And immediately he was told to fire 24 rockets at the thing as soon as he could. And he got a lock on really easily. He said this thing was as big as a B-52 on his radar screen. He'd never seen anything bigger before. But then he had to check his sort of orders. And in doing so, he was fumbling around in the cockpit with no lights on and managed to lose it. The thing just vanished, and he talked to the radar controllers on the ground. They said it vanished from their screen as well. And what was interesting, when he came down, he describes being one of the officials taking him off and meeting this civilian guy who he describes as looking like an IBM salesman wearing this heavy blue overcoat, who asked him a lot of questions about what happened up there, and then told him that if he ever spoke of it, it would be considered a breach of national security and a very grave offence indeed. So he shut up about it for 31 years, only came out in 1988 when he was at a reunion back at RAF Manston where he just spilt the beans, basically, and there was a military historian there who asked the MOD what that was all about.
Well, I mean, this is a serious man, a US Air Force pilot with a serious story. Has he been taken seriously?
The MOD used to destroy all its files after 5 years, and they only stopped doing that in 1967. So the MOD don't actually have any record of this happening. And they say, oh, it's the Americans. The Americans haven't said anything about it. But the word is that what may have happened is this pilot may have been a guinea pig, sort of unwitting guinea pig, and an experiment to test out a bit of kit, which was called Palladium, which the US did develop. And it was for basically imposing phantom aircraft on radar, and they used to try and project planes that weren't there onto the Soviet radar screens. And so they think he might have just been a bit of a test case for this, that maybe there wasn't actually anything there, and that he was about to just fire off a load of missiles off into the sea, that, you know, at nothing.
Are there any other stories that we can believe?
There's some really fascinating ones. There's one from an Alitalia airliner captain who was about 22,000 feet heading over from Milan towards Heathrow. This is back in 1991. And He just saw something out the cockpit about 1,000 feet above them, which he describes as looking like this huge brown missile, and just shouted to his co-pilot to look out as if that would really help. And the Civil Aviation Authority over here has done a full investigation on that. That one's still an unknown, although some people think it may be. There was a spate for selling these absolutely ginormous cigar-shaped balloons back in the sort of 1990s, and they think it may have been one of those that was let off somewhere and just got to this ridiculous height. But even that's quite curious because I don't know if it would have got to 22,000 feet. It's an unknown.
You still feel, don't you, that you're being kept in the dark about something, whether it's UFO or other. One interesting story I know, Tina Turner's private dancing caused a bit of a stir.
Yeah, well, this was, I mean, you have to feel sorry, really, for some of the people at the MOD getting these letters, because a lot of the letters from the public, I mean, some of them actually, sadly, are from clearly disturbed people, but some of them are from people who have seen something and they're just excited and they write in because they want to find out, you know, they're into all of this stuff. But yeah, there was a Tina Turner concert back in 1989, which caused a whole flurry of UFO sightings over London. And it was just an aging rock star.
Okay, and there's a woman from Amazon, though. Let's not forget her.
How can we? There's among all the documents, and these there's 19 files released released as this sort of second tranche of all these sort of Britain's X files, if you like. And among them was a letter from a woman writing to the MOD who claims that sadly she crash landed in World War II in her spacecraft with two fellas she had with her, and who were actually from a different planet. But anyway, she came from Amazon, which was in a system called Sirius, and the planet was full of warrior women. And she included a sketch of herself, which is quite touching because it shows her in full gown regalia with pointy ears and this sort of vaguely oriental face. It's stunning.
And you can see diagrams of some of those alien women at guardian.co.uk/science. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Sonia Rothwell and Phil Maynard. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.